Welcome to New World Notes number 166. This installment is titled Sick of War, and that's exactly how I'm feeling. If you're feeling similarly, or even if not, I hope you'll stay tuned. I was born in 1950, and to the best of my recollection, this country has been at war continuously for these 61 years. Not only that, we've been constantly at war with fourth-rate and tenth-rate foreign powers, none of whom ever posed the slightest threat to our country. Perhaps we reached the nadir when U.S. forces invaded the tiny island nation of Grenada in 1983. Michael Parenti will speak more about that glorious military victory in a few minutes. Now Libya. Iraq, Afghanistan, our own ally Pakistan aren't enough. Now Libya, too. Not only are we waging war against fourth-rate powers that threaten America not in the least, but so-called war now focuses on killing civilians. In World War I, 90% of the deaths were of soldiers. I use the term to include uniformed sailors and airmen. 90%. In World War II, 50% of the deaths were of soldiers. In the Vietnam War, 10% of the deaths were of soldiers. By today, I believe we're down to 5%. 95% of war casualties are civilians. This isn't warfare. This is psychopathy running amok and given carte blanche by Congress. And, of course, there are always the noble-sounding justifications broadcast without question by the Pentagon's collaborators, the corporate-controlled media. Fighting terrorism is a popular justification, and so is protecting civilian lives. Right now, we're protecting civilian lives in Libya by ending thousands of them with bombs and cruise missiles. Protecting lives was the official excuse for sending the U.S. Marines to invade Grenada in 1983. I remember that one. You see, there was a little coup there, and a left-of-center government had come to power. And there was a medical school in Grenada that had some American students in it. We just had to protect them. Of course, the justification was as preposterous as all the other justifications. And weeks later, the American students told reporters that the left-wing government of Grenada had treated them with nothing but courtesy, and none of them had felt the least bit threatened. Too late! By then, we had overthrown the government and killed many hundreds of citizens of this island that probably you cannot find on a map. Hint, it's near Aruba. And I can find it on a map only because I just searched for it 10 minutes ago. The bombs aren't falling on me, but I'm feeling bruised. I'm feeling beaten. I'm paying for this constant murder, and you're paying for this constant murder. And though we can't afford school teachers and road repairs, apparently we can afford all the constant murder we want. Or somebody wants. We'll hear two commentators explain why this madness continues. First, Michael Parenti argues that the real purpose of all U.S. military interventions is to protect the profits of the Fortune 500. That explains Grenada, not to mention Libya and Afghanistan. Then Bruce Gagnon explains that endless war is good business. In fact, it's practically the only manufacturing business the U.S. has left. First, here's Michael Parenti speaking in the early 1990s. So when he talks about the U.S. attack on Iraq, he's referring to Gulf War I of 1991. And yes, we did attack Iraq, not just Kuwait, destroying much of Baghdad from the air and other Iraqi cities.
The United States today maintains the largest global military apparatus in the history of humanity. In fact, the only global one. It's the only one that spans the entire globe. The U.S. has 350 major military bases in some 80 foreign countries, along with about 800 other minor installations in various countries. It has a naval fleet greater in tonnage and firepower than all the other navies combined. It has nuclear-armed this fleet. It sails every ocean. It makes port on every continent, just about. It has bomber squadrons, thousands of nuclear missiles, rapid deployment forces with enough destructive force to obliterate entire populations, as we saw happen in Iraq, a good 100,000 people killed in the first couple of weeks of fighting. In fact, enough destructive force in the U.S. armed forces to obliterate the planet itself. In addition, this U.S. empire has auxiliaries, just as the Roman Empire used to take native troops and arm them and set them up. The U.S. empire has given more than $200 billion in military aid to train, equip, and subsidize over 2 million troops and internal security forces in over as 80 countries. The purpose is being not to defend them from outside invasion, but to defend the ruling oligarchs in these countries from their own populations. Among the recipients of U.S. military aid have been some of the worst murderers and military autocracies on earth, such as Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Morocco, Kuwait, Indonesia, and others too numerous to mention. Haiti, before Aristide and after Aristide. Over the past four decades, the U.S. launched or assisted in the overthrow of popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Greece, Argentina, Bolivia, and Haiti in 91, and numerous other countries, and then supported the conservative military autocracies that replaced them. Well, now, if a goal of U.S. foreign policy is democracy, how do you serve the cause of democracy throughout the world by overthrowing so many democracies? And why did you overthrow them? The U.S. national security state, we're going to answer that question. That's not a rhetorical question. That's not a scold. That's a question to be analyzed. The U.S. national security state has participated in covert actions or brutal mercenary wars against revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, South Yemen, and elsewhere, often with dreadful devastation and loss of life for the indigenous populations. 1/6 of Mozambique's land is cultivated today. In other words, 5/6 of the cultivated land has been wiped out or uninhabitable, made unsafe because of RENAMO and the murderers. In Angola, literally hundreds of thousands have died. 1.5 million people have died in Angola in a CIA-sponsored war. Almost 200,000 have died since that very last election, which UNITA would not recognize because they ran the election, they lost it, and they went back to fighting. Almost 200,000 people. You don't hear about that in the media. We hear about Bosnia, Bosnia, Bosnia. Bosnia is almost a sideshow compared to the kind of killing that's going on in Angola. And there's a reason why you don't hear about it. It's because Angola is a U.S.-sponsored war. And so you don't hear about all the people that are being killed in our free and independent media. Hostile actions by the U.S. leaders have been directed against reformist governments in Egypt, South Yemen, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, the Congo under Lumumba, the Fiji Islands, and you can go on. Since World War II, U.S. military forces have directly invaded or launched aerial attacks, killing large numbers of people in Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia. Before World War II, the U.S. invaded Haiti, Soviet Russia, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. I'll bet you most school kids would be surprised to hear that last one invaded all those different countries. The U.S. has done that. They fought a whole war in China. In fact, I looked at the old records of veterans from 1898, and there was a special category. Did you fight in the Spanish War, the Filipino War, the Boxer Rebellion? U.S. troops were in China fighting. I didn't learn about this in school. I didn't learn about it at Yale graduate school. You get a Ph.D. in political science and you're political illiterate and historical illiterate. They don't tell you what your country has been doing in the world. I mean, you think one of the minimal things you're going to learn is what your country does in the world, especially if you take courses that say U.S. foreign policy and the world, right? You would think you'd learn something about this. Take those courses and never learn what the U.S. has been doing. And by the U.S., I mean the U.S. leaders. By the way, intervention takes other forms. The U.S. national security state finances hundreds of publishing houses, wire services, publications, and other propaganda channels, hundreds of research institutions, conservative political parties, and compliant labor unions, rigged elections, and the like. Why? Why does a professedly peace-loving nation find it necessary to use so much force, violence, and manipulation against so many peoples in so many places? And what's been the cost to the U.S. population itself? That is the question that informs my talk tonight. The nations that feel the brunt of U.S. intervention are not randomly selected. Generally, intervention is directed against governments that have sought to establish political economic independence. Governments that have either tried to drop out of the global free market capitalist system or within the confines of it tried some kind of independent development and redistributive politics. By redistributive politics, I mean that they took some portion of the gross national income and redistributed from column A to column B. From the people in column A, that 2% that live off interest and dividends and land royalties and rents, to the people in column B, the other 98% who live off wages, salaries, commissions, fees, and pensions. And those are the governments, those governments that have pursued that kind of policy are the ones which have been targeted for U.S. intervention. It could be a populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijo and Noriega, or in Egypt under Nasser. It could be a Christian revolutionary one, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democratic popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or in Greece under Papandreou back in the 1960s. It could be a Marxist-Leninist one, as in Cuba or North Korea or Soviet Union. It can be an Islamic revolutionary government, as in Libya under Gaddafi. Even a conservative militarist government, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. I mean, Saddam Hussein was CIA. I mean, who do you think brought him in and got the king out of Iraq? It was the CIA. But he got to be a little too nationalistic. He started to get out of line on oil prices and oil quotas. The goal of U.S. global policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. The purpose is not just to protect direct investments. I mean, there was very little direct investment, U.S. investment in Vietnam, for instance, or in Soviet Russia back in 1920 when the U.S. invaded with 12 other countries. It's to protect the overall global capitalist system. Take the case of Grenada. I remember saying to an acquaintance, I said, why doesn't Reagan invade Grenada? I mean, here's a little revolutionary country of 102,000 people. It's perfectly helpless, and he's a bully, and he would take it, you know, and is trying a revolutionary course. And then I came to the conclusion, and it was foolish of me to say this, I said, oh, it's too small. It's ridiculous to go take U.S. forces and invade. And I didn't realize that nothing's too small for Ronald Reagan. And sure enough, he invaded Grenada. Well, what's the purpose of it? Capitalism would not collapse if Grenada remained revolutionary. And Reagan was right. It wasn't a matter of direct resources that you needed from that country. He said, nutmeg is not the question. I mean, that was Grenada's biggest export. We could get perfectly good nutmeg from Africa. You don't need Grenada's nutmeg. So why did they invade Grenada? They invaded Grenada because they were serving notice to the people of the Caribbean and to the people of Latin America and to the people of the world that you cannot drop out of your client state free market system. That if you try to take an independent source, and that if you use your land, your labor, your resources, and your capital, and your markets in a different way, in a collectivist way, if you use them to benefit the needs of your people rather than to be milked like a cow for foreign investors or whatever else, if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. And the rest of the Caribbean got the message.
In November 2009, I recorded Parenti speaking in West Hartford. Here he interrupts some remarks on Saddam Hussein to talk about our war in the former Yugoslavia. Anybody even remember that one? Early 1990s. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the U.S. and Western Europe did everything they could to break up the Yugoslav Federation. And they succeeded. Then civil war broke out in the former Yugoslav state of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Supposedly to protect the Muslim faction of Bosnia from the ethnic Serb faction of Bosnia, we had to launch a humanitarian intervention, so-called. You know how deeply this country cares about the well-being of Muslims. Supposedly to protect the Bosnian Muslims, NATO bombarded the city of Belgrade, Serbia, among other atrocities. I remember seeing video of Belgrade ablaze, and I was appalled. Serbia was an entirely different country from Bosnia-Herzegovina, and its connection to the Bosnian War was dubious at best. No matter. Years later, U.S. diplomats admitted that our humanitarian excuse for bombing Serbia was total BS. We were teaching Serbia a lesson in economic cooperation. With us. It had nothing to do with Bosnia. Here's Michael Parenti.
Strobe Talbot, who was Deputy Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, came out in an introduction to John Norris's book, and he said, oh, no, I'm sorry. That's Yugoslavia. I'll tell you that anyway. He said, the only reason we really bombed Yugoslavia is they refused to privatize their economy. It had nothing to do with imaginary atrocities and all that. And all sorts of progressives supported that war, you know, stood shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House. But the same thing with Iraq. They went after Saddam Hussein when he started getting out of line. He wanted a larger oil quota. He wanted to be able to sell more oil. It wasn't that, oh, he's going to keep oil. We won't get our oil for our cars and our houses and all that. Quite the contrary. These guys want to sell the oil, but they want to sell it directly and make the profit. They don't want to have to sell it to Chevron and Exxon and all these people. And none of that was ever talked about. None of that. All we got was, out of nowhere, Saddam Hussein was a wicked dictator, and we will have to invade his country and kill him and kill a million of his people and such. And they didn't say that, but that's what the result has been.
One more take on endless war. This is by activist Bruce Gagnon, and also recorded by me in West Hartford in April 2010. During the Vietnam War, there was a bumper sticker that said, "War is good business. Invest your son." The government has since updated its business model, so if you're middle class, it won't be your son. It will be the sons and daughters of the working class and the poor. Still, you can invest most of the federal tax dollars you pay in endless war. And you are. Here's Bruce Gagnon.
I think we must also put war spending into the larger context of U.S. military strategy. So I want to talk about some of that now. So as we're out talking to people that are really listening, we can also talk to them in greater detail because they're listening so hard about what the empire is really all about and what the U.S. military strategy is about today. Let me ask you a question. What is the number one industrial export product of America today? That's right, weapons. And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? That's right, endless war. The more, the better. You know, I like to say that if shoes were our number one industrial export product, we'd say, we're going to put a shoe on every person's foot of the world, ladies and gentlemen. And that's what we're doing with weapons today. The Pentagon, actually, since the Bush administration and now into the Obama administration, is saying that under corporate globalization of the world economy, every country is going to have a different role, a different job. They say, we're not going to make things in America anymore. We're not going to make shoes. We're not going to make cars. We're not going to make refrigerators. We're not going to make clothes. Because it's cheaper to go overseas, right? To China or India or Indonesia, other places where people working for almost nothing, corporations can maximize profits. And so the Pentagon says that our role under corporate globalization will be security export. Security export. And they define it. You see, the Pentagon says there's a part of the world that is not today submitting to the authority of corporate globalization. They call it the non-integrating gap. The non-integrating gap. And they say our job under security export, under corporate globalization, will be to go into the non-integrating gap and bring about compliance. And they spell out just who that non-integrating gap is. The Middle East, where, of course, we invaded Iraq in 2003 in shock and awe, and where today we have permanent bases, and no matter what your president tells you, the troops are not all coming home. Central Asia, where we are today in Afghanistan, building permanent bases in what used to be defined as the Soviet Union's backyard. And if during the Cold War, at the time of the Soviet Union, if the United States had tried to set up bases in this part of Central Asia, we would have gone to nuclear war with each other over it, because it would have been the reverse of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But there we are today. Africa, also part of this non-integrating gap, where the Pentagon is saying we'll be fighting 20 years from now for their oil and their natural resources. And then finally, parts of Latin America, places like Venezuela, that has a lot of oil. And Hugo Chavez is not doing what he's told by the corporations. So our job again then will be to go into the non-integrating gap and bring compliance. And they say that because of space technology, because space coordinates all warfare on the earth today, when the U.S. launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons were directed to their targets by space satellites. So no matter whether you're in a tank, on a plane, on a boat, or driving a Humvee around the streets of Baghdad or Kabul, and you're looking at the little screen on the computer inside the Humvee, the streets of Baghdad, and you're busting down doors and pulling people out in the middle of the night, you're coordinated by space technology, because your computer in that Humvee is hooked up to that satellite, giving you that map. And that's the way it all runs today. And so they say because of that, because of this, what they call net-centric warfare, there's really no distinction anymore, they say, between the old services. They said that those lines are being erased between the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. And they say in the future, we're essentially going to have two forces in the military. One is called Leviathan. And their job is to go in an overwhelming attack. Devastating, shock and awe, go in and just hit them hard, hit them strong. Nobody can stand up to us. Destroy them totally. Leviathan. And the other service, they say, is called SysAd, Systems Administration. After we've gone in with Leviathan, Systems Administration comes in after that to run the country. And they say these troops will never come home. And Lockheed Martin is now being given huge amounts of money to train soldiers in systems administration, empire building. So the Pentagon says we won't have industrial jobs anymore. Kids in America, especially working class and poor kids, will have no other option. They will join the military. It's called the economic draft. Have you heard about Sears, that Sears has a new line of kids' clothing? Have you heard about it? Army uniforms? I didn't believe it when I heard about it. So I went to our local Sears store in nearby Brunswick, and there they were, right in there, a line of kids' clothing, all Army uniforms. A friend of mine in Maine told me a story about a birthday party for about a 6 or 7 year old kid. They called the National Guard, and the National Guard brought in a Humvee and a truck, set up a big army tent, set up guns. And so the kids all at the birthday party got to climb all over the trucks and play with the guns. They're doing birthday parties now because they understand that they need to begin training these kids that this is all you can be. This is your future under security export. There will be no jobs. There will be no college education for the working class and poor kids in America. Higher education will be only for the really brilliant students and for the children of the wealthy and the upper class. Endless war. But what does it say, friends, about the soul of our nation? What does it say about us as a people? That we have to have endless war in order to provide jobs so people can put food on the tables for their families. What does it say about the very soul of us as American people? We all know that fossil fuels are a declining natural resource on our fragile Mother Earth. Many experts say that we've reached the peak of oil availability and are now quickly heading down the hill towards scarcity at the very time that global demand for oil is growing. Again, Noam Chomsky says U.S. foreign policy is today all about controlling the world's oil supply as a lever of world domination. One way to keep Europe and China and India and other emerging markets dependent on the United States and in sync with our policies is to maintain control of the oil supply that they're relying upon. So even as the U.S. economy is collapsing, the Pentagon appears to be saying that whoever controls the keys to the world's economic engine still remains in charge.
Thanks for listening. If I had another 4 minutes, I would have inserted a comic song into the middle to lighten things up a bit. Well, like Howard Beale in the movie Network, I want you to get mad. I want you to say, I'm a human being, damn it, my life has value. And I want you to stick your head out the window and shout, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Okay, it's a long shot. What the heck, it couldn't hoit. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of the University of Hartford. It'll get to my non-carborundum, don't take any wooden nickels, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao. So if you rules, bring them home.